call the House
Judiciary Committee order Tuesday, February 9th, 2012. Last night, I want to announce that House Bill 4084 and 4085 were heard. They're going to move 4084. This bill will not be moving. I believe both people that signed up were there last night. So get a hold of Chair Gilliam of the other committee that's going to continue that bill. And that'll be off the agenda today. And open a public hearing on House Bill 4017. Representative Smith, would you bring up anyone that you need to have with you?
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing the good citizens of Northeast Oregon up in Union and Wallawa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. I also serve as your co-chair on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Public Safety. Today I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4017 and ask for your support and ask you to send this down to the Ways and Means Committee. Let me share with you just a very, very brief story. Back in my youth, when I was about 18, 19 years old and had a few more strands of hair on the top of the head, I was in Tillamook Bay. I was crabbing. And I was over in the Pirate's Cove area, if anyone knows where that is in Tillamook Bay. And I was out there with a bunch of my buddies, and we were just having a great time. And by the way, what I'm about to share with you has a little bit of humor in it. But it has a serious point that's going to follow. I'm out there crabbing with my buddies, and all of a sudden I see this man who's about 45 years old standing in nothing but his boxers and a pair of work boots out on the cove. And this guy was drunk as could be. Drunk. His buddies, who he was crabbing with, had about enough of him and threw him off the boat and left him out there and said, figure out your own way home.
They're probably all from Eastern Oregon.
They're all from Eastern Oregon. Well, anyway, you know, we were young. We didn't know what we were doing. We went and picked this fella up, put him in our boat, and this guy was just, he was gone. He was just completely intoxicated. Well, we took him back to Garibaldi, dropped him off, and, you know, we were laughing at him, thinking it was kind of funny and humorous as he walked off in his boxer shorts and his boots. What then happened was life-changing for me, and that is I watched him get into his tire, grab a set of keys, jump into his rig, and off he went. And right there I realized I played just that small little part in perhaps allowing this gentleman to take off. And that thought's never left me. I'm hoping I can now make a little bit of a difference and correct that decision I made when I was a youngster. And what House Bill 4017 does is it would require an interlock, ignition interlock, on those vehicles that perhaps could be driven by your most dangerous DUI offenders. These are those folks who have been convicted of DUIs four or more times in the last 10 years. These are those folks who have third-time misdemeanor DUI lifetime, their lifetime offenders. Also those who have been committed of assault, one as a result of a DUI, and DUII homicide offenders, along with aggravated vehicular homicide. Colleagues, your Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety is ready to capture this bill. We have federal funding available to implement the cost of this bill, and we had asked for your support to correct a wrong that needs to be corrected. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And after Representative Hunt testifies, I was going to make the statement you know, do you want to keep talking or do you want us to pass your bill?
I had to tell you my funny story.
This one is going to move, and so we just need the basics, and I think Mrs. Pratt understands that. Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I would just make one point in support of House Bill 4017. It really directly connects to the work that this committee did in the 2011 session and that the legislature passed when we imposed on first-time offenders. First-time people who had been caught for the first time, which, as you recall the testimony, is not the first time they'd been driving. On average, they had been driving drunk 87 times at the time of that first offense. But it imposed a requirement that they install an ignition interlock device that complied with the term of their diversion agreements. This really covers a different group of people. Those who have already gotten to a point of several, as Representative Smith said, to a point of extreme multiple convictions of felony DUII. And fundamentally, the beauty of this, unlike so many bills that we consider in this legislature, and I've introduced them and you probably have too, bills that end up resulting in prison costs, which is cost to all the taxpayers. The beauty of this bill, as well as House Bill 3075 that you passed during the regular session, is it doesn't have that cost. The burden is on the person who has to install the device. In this case, some of the cost is covered by a federal transportation safety grant. This is a great way for us to get tough on crime, but also to be smart on crime and very judicious with our dollars, and I urge your support.
Good morning, Co-Chair Sparker and Krieger. For the record, my name is Ann Pratt, and I'm with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I will try very hard not to repeat anything that's been said and to be really brief. Thank you to Representative Smith and Representative Hunt for co-sponsoring this bill. House Bill 4017 is an opportunity to significantly improve public safety on our roadways. The House Judiciary passed a similar bill in the last session unanimously, and it did go to Ways and Means, but got stuck there like a lot of other good policy bills. We now know what 4017 does and what offenders are involved. The only thing I would like to add about that is that under present law, if when these offenders do are reinstated, they would only receive two years on the ignition interlock, and we need to set them aside because they are our worst offenders, and MAD recommends somewhere between 5 and 10, and I think 5 years is enough to make a difference and to retrain these offenders and keep the rest of us safe. I'd like to point out a couple of good things. One of them is that, and I think you just heard that the offender is responsible for the cost and not the taxpayer. We also have the Transportation Safety Grant using federal funds to pay for this. There are 10 other states that have very similar bills, laws. The other good news that I can't help but share is that in 2008, we had 238 DUI fatalities. In 2009, we had 180. This year, we have 139. It's down 99 people. So we're doing the right thing. House Bill 4017 is also supported by the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, Crime Victims United, Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Oregon State Sheriff's Association. MAD urges you to pass 4017 with the -1 amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, very quickly, I want to introduce to you Hayden Perkins. Hayden is from Baker City. He's a student at Southern Oregon University, and this week is interning in our office. And I've asked him just to share about a minute and a half worth of thoughts.
Hopefully. Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Hayden Perkins, and I reside in Medford, Oregon. As a student at Southern Oregon University, drunk driving has regularly claimed the lives of my loved ones and loved ones of my peers. And I'm not alone. We all know of one, five, or sometimes dozens of friends and family who have been killed or seriously injured, both physically and mentally, at the hands of drunk drivers. The very worst part of it is that too often these same drunk drivers kill their passengers, but then go on to live themselves and drink and drive again. And even the surviving passengers of drunk drivers get caught up in the lifestyle and then drink and drive themselves. I've watched this firsthand. My significant other alone has lost about half a dozen old high school friends and acquaintances due to DUI-related incidents just in the past 3 years. Some were drivers making poor choices, and others were just close friends who simply rode in the wrong car. Just this Sunday, in fact, Super Bowl Sunday, another one of her friends was killed on the freeway, and she was devastated. The cycle simply needs to stop. Many of these examples were only possible because of drivers who insisted on perpetuating their condition by failing to learn from their own actions or the examples set by their peers. And each and every one of these individuals, I feel, could have benefited from House Bill 4017. Personally, I would like to see fewer funerals or graduation. I'd like to see fewer news articles and tears upon them, fewer empty seats at schools and the dinner tables. And most importantly, I want to see more of these bright minds escape the cycle and go on to do great things for our state and nation. And I really think that House Bill 4017 is a great step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith, there's a dash one. Was there a dash one?
There is a dash one amendment, and it's really a technical amendment. It's on... Section 2 is on page 3.
I don't believe we have that.
So I know this had to do with changing from saying like laws to rules, because some of this is administrative rules that comes in, just a technical fix.
It changes it from pertaining to crimes to
relating
to.
We would like to have the dash 1 in the bill, but if we don't have it, we can't put it in. Have you got a copy of it?
I have.
Okay.
It deletes the word crimes and inserts suspension or revocation. That's all that it does. Committee, do you need to have a copy of that?
I have two, Mr. Chair. I think we're handed out this morning.
Yeah, I didn't have one in my packet.
No, I didn't
either. Not ready? Well, we got some more people to testify. Yes. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I also don't have a fiscal.
Has a fiscal been done on the bill? My name is Shannon Newell. For the record, I provided fiscals to the co-chairs, but I can give one to you.
Do we all need it?
We never have seen. I just checked the office. We never got a copy of the dash one amendments. We are required to send the dash one amendments to legislative fiscal and legislative revenue to get a revenue fiscal impact. So we have the paperwork for the bill as originally drafted. We don't have it for the amendment.
We have.
By Monday, we would, in fact, have everything, so there's no hang-up.
Right.
You're going to be down in the Ways and Means. You're going to understand what's coming and when and why it might be a little late, but we'll get it out Monday. But I do want the other people to have an opportunity to testify, so we probably won't move the bill today. But it will go.
We appreciate that, Mr. Co-Chair. And as I look at the membership of your committee, our good co-chair, who's on public safety, is to my right, and two of our vice co-chairs are right in front of me. So, thank you.
Chair Krieger and Bill Taylor, I don't know if this document, this is what I got off of line yesterday. It just says it's a fiscal impact of proposed legislation, and I don't know if that's...
Include the dash ones?
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, we'll get this all taken care of and get this to
All right, thank you. We've got a few more people I want to give an opportunity to come up.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have Gail Meyer, Daryl Fuller, and Jason Carlisle, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Let me say at the outset of my comments, if I might, it's a simple statement. OCDLA supports safe roads. We use them. Our loved ones use them. Our children use them. We have a perspective of these kind of bills from the vantage point of the people who are driving drunk or the ones talking to them about what promotes them to engage in safe behavior and how it is that they lapse. Our position on this bill is really nuanced. What we're suggesting to the committee is perhaps Oregon is kind of missing the mark on the bigger picture, and we as an organization want to take a closer look at what goes on in the state of Washington with respect to their ignition interlock device laws and bring those back to the committee possibly in 2013. What Washington does is they don't rely on lengthy suspension periods as an aspect of public safety. What they do is they take these crimes, they do impose a suspension period or revocation period, but then they have allowances quite early in where the offender can apply for an ignition interlock license. It is on their license, and so any vehicle that they're driving, they are obligated to have an interlock device on that vehicle. But what we're finding is, and quite frankly, we don't think that there's that much disagreement, is that lengthy suspension periods do not forestall driving. The reality is people will be driving. They do drive. They have to get to the grocery store before the snowstorm comes. They go. What having an ignition interlock license does is that it promotes licensed driving and sober driving. And we think that what we'd like to do is take a look at the statistics and the law that passed up in Washington in 2009 and perhaps bring that back to the committee in 2013 for a look at it. But we just think that's a bigger policy perspective here that we think ought to be considered.
Co-chair is Jason Carlisle, Linn County DA for ODAA. Ms. Pratt already said what I was going to say. We support this.
Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and recognizing the admonition from Representative Krieger, I'll just mention that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association does support the bill, although the testimony just presented does make me think just off the top of my head that rather than putting the device on the vehicles after the suspension is over, maybe we want to put them on immediately, since she indicates that they're driving while they're suspended anyway. I'm not sure why we're waiting until the suspension is over to put the device on the vehicles. It might prevent some of them from being able to start the vehicles while they're under suspension. But that's something we can look at later. Thank you.
We do have other laws that cover that. Darrell, there's nothing to prevent that person from driving somebody else's car that doesn't have the device on it. And that's not a violation, is it?
Yeah.
I think so. They're required to have an interlock. That person may not even know. I'll look into that. Anything? Any questions in the panel? Okay, thank you. And the last three that are signed up is Perkins, Hackle Road, Joyce, and Fisher, please.
Based on your comments, Chair Krieger, Doug Hackle Road, for the record, I don't need to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. With me is Linda Fisher-Lewis from the Department's Transportation Safety Division to speak to the grant money that's been discussed.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, I'm Linda Fisher-Lewis, the Impaired Driving Program Manager for the State of Oregon, and I will be facilitating the grant for the fiscal on this bill.
Ms. Chair?
Yes.
I think it was Representative Hunt or Smith, it doesn't matter. They both said that this was paid for by the
grant.
But yeah, and then how come it says $122,000 general fund? How's that work? Because that's a, can you explain that to me? Anybody explain that to me?
Chair Krieger and Chair Schaffler, I have not seen that, or Representative Schaffler, I have not seen that document. My understanding that the fiscal that ODOT submitted indicated approximately.
Oh, Mr. Chair, forgive me. Different bill.
Chair Krieger and
That's
Representative
the first
Schaffler,
mistake
that explains
he's made
the
since he's been here.
Mr. Chair, we're moving too fast.
All right, excuse me.
Any questions? Thank you. That's all those that have signed up. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4017.
The staff is trying to confuse me.
And we will move it forward till Monday. Hopefully we'll have for a work session only on that date. We'll put the amendment in then. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4146.
Good morning, members of the committee, Co-Chair Krieger. For the record, my name is Chana Newell. House Bill 4146 is sponsored by Representative Jefferson Smith at the request of the Center for Christian Voices. In your packet that you just received, you should see that there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for this bill, and it has no subsequent referral. As of the moment, we have both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. I believe the Dash 2s are the ones that are under consideration, but we'll hear more about that. This bill would allow the expunction of juvenile charges or adjudication for prostitution when the person was less than 18 years of age at the time of the offense.
Jefferson Smith, Representative Jefferson Smith, is on the way from another committee, is there? So we're not quite ready.
It's not here.
He's coming. Okay. Smith is on the way.
Yeah, to make use of our time, let's have Maura Roach and is it Lindsay Nelson? Come up, please.
So Chairman Barker, Chairman Krieger, and members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you for the chance to testify and for your work surrounding House Bill 4146. For the record, my name is Lindsay Nelson, and I'm coming representing the Oregon Center for Christian Voices, also known as OCCV. The Oregon Center for Christian Voices unites Christians to seek God's justice in Oregon. We base our personal and public values on the life of Christ as taught to us in the Bible and advocate for policies which reflect this care for the poor, the oppressed, and the most vulnerable. Our main focus areas are poverty, healthcare, environment, and human trafficking. As an Oregon resident and human trafficking head of the OCCV Legislative Committee, I worked with community stakeholders and Representative Jefferson Smith's office in developing House Bill 4146. The representative will speak more about the amendments and the specifics of the bill. Fighting for victim rights has been a passion of mine for many years. During my undergraduate studies in human services, I interned for a year at the Marion County District Attorney Victims Assistance Office, where I case managed a plethora of sex abuse, child abuse, and domestic violence cases. I saw both the short and long-term distress and obstacles, including unjust convictions that victims faced in being able to move forward with their lives after victimization. Seeing those stories compelled me to commit myself to making structural transformation occur in criminal justice systems. Today, I'm completing my master's in public administration, serving workers through the state, and volunteering in community organizing and legislative efforts with that goal in mind. As many of you may know, human trafficking really is an issue that affects Oregon. 200,000 to 300,000 youth are sexually exploited each year in the United States, which is just a portion of the $5 billion international industry of commercial sexual exploitation of children. This issue is not only rampant abroad, it is here in our backyard. It's been said that Portland has the most sex trafficking per capita in the nation, not something we want to be known for. Law enforcement and advocate statistics have shown that about 90% of the victims interviewed in Multnomah County had some tie locally. They're our daughters. As Rachel Lloyd says, under the law, one child is a victim of statutory rape and another child is considered a willing participant because money was exchanged. As Jefferson Smith will discuss, the point is it's a catch-22. They can't be both, not give consent, and be victims of statutory rape and yet also be charged. And so luckily, in practice, they're not being charged anymore, but there are felons that have come of age that are now being affected by these charges that were they were being charged in juvenile adjudications. Jessica Richardson, a survivor of sex trafficking, is a great example of how conviction for crimes related to the trafficking keeps such survivors from moving ahead. She is a local well-known spokesperson on the issues related to trafficking. She has a blog with a story at her name, the website. She recently has been going to trafficking conferences, and she did speak at our hearing in Multnomah County for our shelter that was passed. And moving forward, Jessica had to not only do extreme couponing to feed her five children, but start her own business because she could not get hired anywhere due to the victimization-related convictions. And she's very public about the fact that she could had such trouble with employment and housing because of that. She is just one of many survivors being continually re-victimized by these barriers caused by our system that should focus as much on justice as criminals. I believe it will be worth it if only one victim is able to move forward with their lives due to the passage of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 4146.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach. I'm testifying on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice. Youth Rights and Justice supports House Bill 4146. We believe this bill is an important step in drawing a clearer distinction between the young victims of sex trafficking and the adults who create the demand and profit from sex trafficking. House Bill 4146 allows for the expunction of a juvenile record immediately upon turning 18 years of age. The bill removes the current waiting period for this offense only, and the bill is narrowly focused on one type of crime, minors who've been sex trafficked. We understand there are a number of amendments for the bill to clarify the narrowness of the exemption, and I am pleased to tell you we don't have concerns about any of them. So I expect one of those will be moving forward today. Youth Rights and Justice fully supports 4146 because it gives persons who have been previously victims of sex trafficking but treated as delinquents the opportunity to expunge the record in a more expeditious manner. This is an important step in helping these young people move forward with their lives. We urge your support. Thank you.
Committee, have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll stand by for a minute, see if you can get here.
So, Mr. Chair, do we have anybody here that could address the dash, I mean the amendments?
Okay. Gina, do you have the amendment and understand it? You can explain what the amendment does.
Yes, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments clarify that if it is a charge or an allegation and not just an adjudication, that that can be expunged because, as you heard in testimony, sometimes it is not charged in practice. Prostitution is not charged in practice. So it just clarifies that it is a charge, an allegation, or an adjudication based on conduct that if it was done by an adult, if it was prostitution, if it had been an adult who could consent, then it would be the crime of prostitution. It also clarifies that only the portion of the record that relates to the charge of prostitution is expunged, nothing else. So you couldn't have another crime that is also expunged along with it.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the State House, and appreciate your patience as I walked up from committee. First of all, thank you for the support of, I think, every member of this, nearly every member of this committee, for the work that we did in the 2010 attend short session before what we think was Oregon's first modest step on addressing human trafficking, raising awareness when we passed the hotline bill then. I want to specifically call out Representative Tomei for her persistent and consistent leadership on this set of issues. It's notoriously hard to track down the scope of this challenge, but we know that the I-5 corridor is a trafficking pipeline. We know that gangs are increasingly involved in forcing young girls into prostitution. With elevated penalties for drug crimes, child prostitution can offer a more lucrative risk-reward calculus. In Oregon, we recognize that juveniles can't consent to sexual conduct, and local jurisdictions have almost all stopped charging children with prostitution, but this is a recent change. And there are still some young adults whose re-entry into society is made more difficult by a prostitution charge while they were a child sex trafficking victim. This bill will allow a judge to expunge a prostitution adjudication, and thank you, Representative Olson, for the questions that you helped raise with district attorneys to make sure and clear that it is strictly the prostitution adjudication once the victim has reached 18. The expungement will cover only the prostitution adjudication, not other crimes. We know that victims often face significant challenges recovering from child sex trafficking. Oregon should join Illinois in creating a process to expunge adjudications and ease reentry into society. And with that, I will be mercifully brief.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. 82nd Avenue is my far west boundary. I believe it touches on your district, too, or if not, it's right close. And
just barely not.
You drive down that street and you see these young people out there and you don't know what's going on, but you know something's wrong. And it ain't right. And sometimes it's just being the father of an 18-year-old, I guess I can't politically correctly call her a girl anymore. She's an 18-year-old woman. And I just shudder at the thought of her being out on that street, which she's never even walked on 82nd Avenue. Now, I was a rather wild youth. That may come as a surprise to some of you. But I did some things that I shouldn't have been doing, and I've done background checks on myself. It's not there, and these young people, if they want to drag themselves out of a living hell, the last thing we should do is put an obstacle in their way. We should do everything we can to get them out of that living hell. It's just horrible. I really appreciate this bill. I don't know what we're going to do with it, but I think we need to do something, and we have to do a lot more with it.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I just want to kind of take a look at the Dash 2 amendments here really quick, because it addresses the issue about the record that involves a charge, allegation, or adjudication. I guess I'm a little bit confused why expunction would be involved in that if a charge was, that's all it was, and then it was never adjudicated, or why an allegation, but it was never adjudicated. To the point, I mean, where, you know, there was a fine or some type of action taken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. My impression is there's even a stronger argument to expunge a non-adjudicated charge than there is the adjudication itself. I'm not clear. I don't and haven't practiced criminal law myself. So in terms of how often it is that charges linger in this kind of case, I can't be sure. We are bringing this language not only after having worked with district attorneys, but also with Commissioner McKeel's office and the Oregon Center for Christian Values, who have helped with the language, and I want to thank them. I do know that in other instances, charges can stay on the books, even if that's all it was an arrest and a charge, and there was never a conviction. And erasing that charge seems to be as nearly as important as erasing an adjudication.
Just a little different direction here. Do you know what the volume is or the number of these in Multnomah County?
We don't. And if that information is available, we can try to track it down. I'm not sure that there has been a cataloging done to capture them all, but I can ask. I was about to say I will gather information. I'm quite confident I will not, but I can ask somebody to, and I bet Lucy will do her best.
Okay. Thank you.
And sort of pick up on Representative Olson's thread, I just want to say I think the utility of this bill and of the Dash 2 amendments is that a lot of times getting a youth into the system is the best thing could ever happen to them. And the only way to get them in really is by arresting them, potentially filing a charge. But the utility of the Dash 2 amendments is that they can put them on probably a formal accountability agreement. A DA's diversion would be the comparable thing for the adult system. And they don't have to get convicted ultimately, but while they're in the formal accountability agreement, they're being handled by the juvenile system. And I mean, the juvenile system has a lot of power once a person has been brought into it to frankly change their life. That's one of the things it's designed and intended to do. So that's what I think the utility of the Dash 2 amendment is, that they can get them in the system without actually getting them convicted of a crime, a juvenile conviction, and still get it expunged. So it makes a lot of sense to me.
Parker. Thank you. And I want to thank you for bringing this forward. This is really important, and it's kind of off most people's radar because most people aren't Johns. Most of their daughters are our daughters, are not prostitutes. They get caught up in that, but it's a huge problem. And I had I had a family member who was involved in the prosecution of this stuff. There's a grouper that's called MOB, Money Over Bitches, and where some father suddenly finds his daughter gone. They run around, kind of a tough crowd, and all of a sudden they're gone, and they're gone. They're down in Las Vegas the next night working. And it isn't what the girl really intended to do, but they get caught up in that. They're using the dope, and then all of a sudden they're in the middle of this human trafficking. The public watches movies like Pretty Woman. There was an old movie called Night Shift where these guys ran prostitution out of a funeral home, and it was all ha-ha-ha funny. That isn't real life. These people are truly victims, the young girls especially. And it's a brutal existence. It isn't like Pretty Woman. And I really appreciate what you're trying to do there. We can get these kids in early enough, get them into the system, and then get them out, and then get their record clean, get them on, and hopefully with a very prosperous and good life. But this is a horrific event, and most of them, and virtually all these young girls have been abused before in their life, and they're just very vulnerable. And the people, the pimps, if you will, they know how to pick those girls out, and they'll grab them, and they're gone. And it's just, I've seen the girls, I've seen their parents, and seen the devastation and the pimp. So I really appreciate your effort on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson, can you address the expungement work group and a little bit of our concern?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members have been involved in a work group that has been dealing with expunction. There's been a number of folks from the defense attorney side. Gail Myers is one of those that's on board from OCDLA. We also have three members from the DA's association as well. Bill Taylor has been involved. Josh Naspi has been involved too from Legislative Council. We've met a number of times, and we're just really kind of taking a look at the whole section in the criminal code dealing with expunction. I mean, it's been a long time coming to deal with it. This would have been one of the areas that we most definitely would have dug into the weeds on a lot deeper than what you were talking about today. I get where Representative Jefferson Smith is wanting to go with this thing right now and the timeliness of it. Again, I would like to have the opportunity to, you know, for the work group to really get out and deal with this right now. So, but with that saying, I'll support what the bill is right now.
Any further comments or questions?
We heard last year a lot of testimony sort of confirming what Representative Barker is saying about these young girls and the problems. And I can appreciate what you've been doing, Representative Olson, but I think this is very timely and very important for these kids when they get out of that business, and they need to be able to make a living and erase this part of their lives. So I'm hoping that the committee will pass this bill with the amendments. And thank you again for working on this.
I have to admit, you know, I had some reservations. I talked to Representative Barker and Representative Olson. But I kind of go back to what Representative Tomei was saying from last session, the testimony we heard of what's going on, and perhaps we don't want to wait until the expansion work group. So what we're probably going to do, if it's all right with you, we will put the Dash 2s in
roll it over for a work session on Monday to let the fiscal and revenue catch up. If it doesn't, we'll suspend the rules and send it down to Ways and Means.
Appreciate that very much. And if I could just say two things, co-chairs, members of the committee. The first of all, I want to applaud Representative Olson's work on the expenditure work group. And as we discussed, hopefully this can be a help give that group a running start in those discussions and not interfere with that work. And I don't think there's any reason that it need to. And the last thing I want to offer is just a note of sort of obvious humility that just as some of the work that we have done in the past on this is a small drop in a big rain barrel, this too will not do nearly enough to address this challenge, and I hope that members of this committee will continue to be vigilant here and look at what can be done around shelter beds, around continuing changes in the law, and with Representative Tomei's leadership and others, we will have this be more of a start and less of a finish.
Mr. Chair, my agenda shows that this bill does not have a referral to Ways and Means.
Well, if we don't send it to Ways and Means, we'll take a look and see what the revenue impact statement says when we get it. If it doesn't, we'll take it to the floor, and I think I know someone that would like to carry it. Any further questions? Okay, I want to make open a work session on 4146.
Thank you very much.
For the purpose of getting the amendment.
Chairman Krieger, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 4146.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 4146. Any discussion? Objections? If not, the amendments are in. We will carry it forward till Monday for the paper to catch up with it, and we'll hear it again Monday, and it will be a work session only. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 4146, and we'll drop down to House Bill 4159, Representative Brewer.
Should these folks sign in? There's three of them. Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee for giving us this public hearing and possible work session. This bill, House Bill 4159, is a bill truly born of the citizens of my district in downtown Hillsborough, which is the county seat of Washington County. What this bill is targeted at is better protection of residents in specific residential treatment facilities and also the community in which these facilities are in. You will hear testimony rather compelling from these citizens. These are my neighbors. You will hear rather compelling testimony from them about the need for this. What this bill addresses are residential treatment facilities that hover around the bottom threshold of requiring licensing. And what we want to do is remove that ambiguity of what is required to be licensed. And I think you'll hear the reason for it. Our bill is very simple. It adds it clarifies two additions to what is required for licensing. One is management of medicine, and the other is having access to on-site care rather than having 24-hour on-site care. And then I have two amendments, dash one and dash two. I'm going to not speak a lot more now, allow our citizens to provide testimony, and then I will explain the dash one and two amendments. They go in two opposite directions, and at this point I'd like to turn the mic over, if that's okay, to our first person. I think it's yeah, I think that's okay.
Good morning, Co-Chair Baker and Co-Chair Krieger and committee. My name is Judy Palumbo. I'm from Hillsborough, and I am here representing the Hillsborough Neighborhoods Coalition. We are, I'd like to introduce our coalition. We are comprised of several neighborhoods in and around the downtown Hillsborough area. We represent, we currently represent over 1,000 families, and our primary focus is on advocating and promoting livability issues in our community. I'd like to give you a little bit of background about why we're here. In July 2010, a resident of an unlicensed facility, a residential facility in our downtown area, left late in, on two consecutive evenings and broke into an apartment and raped a 21-year-old woman. The second night, he broke into a private home and sexually assaulted a young child. We held, of course, the community was quite reeling from these crimes, and we subsequently held two community meetings to determine the nature of this facility that was in our community, because we knew very little about it. It's the Luckdorf Safe Haven and Hertner House facility. We had been led to believe that it would be a 10-bed facility for the homeless and the chronically mentally ill. What we found out during these meetings was that it was an unlicensed facility, and that it was a 25-bed dual diagnosis facility, which means that they took in people that were both mentally ill and had addiction problems. It also had a very strong forensics component, which none of us, nobody in our community was aware of. Over 50% of their population comes from the community corrections department. Telly Heath, who was the perpetrator of the 2010 crimes, was a forensics client at the facility and had been placed there by Washington County Community Corrections. He eventually pleaded guilty to the crimes and has been sentenced to 38 years in prison. In our review of the facility and trying to determine exactly what the facility was and what they were doing, we found out that they provided a wide array of services to their clients, that they took in forensics clients, that it appeared in our reading of state law that they required licensing. But the operators of the facility claim that it was only an apartment complex and that they were operating only under landlord-tenant law. It appeared to us that they were exploiting loopholes, some minor loopholes, in the licensing requirements that had already been laid out by the state. And I think you received an electronic copy of a complaint that we filed with the state. Our lawyer also agrees that the facility most likely requires licensing. One thing that licensing would do is it would provide the oversight necessary to meet safety, staffing, and operational requirements that have been defined by administrative rules by the state of Oregon. Telly Heath was not the only example of residents in unlicensed facilities leaving and committing crimes. A very recent example is David Allen Baker. I'm not sure if you're familiar. It was just a few weeks ago that he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. He was a two-time convicted child rapist. He was under the auspices of Multnomah County Community Corrections. He was being housed at Central City Concern Shoreline Apartments, another unlicensed facility. He left that facility on a number of occasions, came to our community, Hillsborough, where he stalked and sexually harassed a 13-year-old girl. He had been previously deemed mentally ill and a dangerous sexual predator, but he was being housed in an unlicensed facility where there was no supervision and no oversight of his activities. I'm here today to give my support to House Bill 4159. Our coalition is committed to working towards licensing and oversight of all residential treatment facilities as provided by state law. We believe that lax licensing standards put both the clients and the community at risk. As Oregon is looking to move more people into community-based residential treatment centers, taking people out of prisons and jails and the state hospital and moving them into our communities, we think it's imperative that we have strong licensing standards so that the people who run these facilities have some accountability and are forced to abide by the Oregon standards that are already set forward in treatment and care. We believe that licensing will bring a higher level of care to some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, and that it's paramount that the state ensure their safety, care, and treatment, and that the standards are of the highest quality. Unfortunately, the current system failed Telly Heath, and he is now going to spend 38 years of his life in prison. The system also failed David Allen Baker, who will spend the rest of his life in prison. It failed the people who were the victims of these people, and our communities are left to wonder what we are going to end up facing next. If the clients are successful, everybody benefits. We would like to see... We don't disagree with having facilities in our community and integrating people back into the community, but we do think that there needs to be properly trained staff, a structured environment, appropriate care and treatment to enhance the success of everybody. It would also provide peace of mind for the communities where these facilities reside. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Any questions?
Who is Linda or?
Do you want to go next?
Sure. Thank you. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk with you today. It's really emotional for me because.
Your name?
I'm sorry. Let me take a deep breath here. My name's Todd Harple. I am the father of the little girl. Sorry, it's difficult to keep bringing this back, but I moved to Oregon in 2005 to take up a job with Intel. Thank you. And because we knew I'd be traveling a lot, we decided we'd live close to work in the heart of Hillsboro, and we like old houses, so we bought this stately old house. It's been on the market forever in the heart of Hillsboro. It's almost fortress-like, and you know, we've been putting a lot of time and energy into it. And that becomes important because of the nature of the crime. It's an old house, and in July of 2010, it was very hot. You might recall it was like in the 90s, and my kids that day were outside playing in the sprinklers. I have 10-year-old twins. They were 10 at the time, and I have a 4-year-old as well. He's 4 now. They're playing in the sprinklers because it was so hot. Well, that night, my daughter's room is on the upper floor, so she asked my wife if she could stay downstairs in the guest bedroom, where she often had sleepovers with her girlfriends. And so, of course, my wife said, sure. Takes her downstairs, puts a screen in the window, and closes the curtain. And not 2 hours after my wife went to sleep that night, somebody came in through that window, removed the screen. And over the course of about an hour and a half that he spent inside my home, he went back and forth between the kitchen where he got a knife and threatened my daughter, back to the bedroom where he assaulted her multiple times, where she fought him off and wouldn't let him rape her. She actually fought him off. He questioned her about my other children. He asked, where's your little brother? He asked, where's your mother? He asked where my wife's purse was. My daughter was so strong, she told him nothing. But he spent over an hour and a half in my house. And finally, when he went to leave, he grabbed my wife's cell phone, which I bought for her. It was kind of quirky, but it was white in color. It was our ivory anniversary gift. And he grabbed the cell phone and had the wherewithal to grab the cell phone, the charger, and the headset. And he left. Well, the door slammed when he left, and my daughter chased him, telling him to put back whatever he'd taken, because it wasn't right. Fortunately, she saw him under the light of that room. She saw his stature, saw his clothing and everything. And the door slammed, so my wife heard it upstairs, came running down the stairs, because she figured it was just the wind blowing through an old house, you know how that does, and the doors slam. And she ran into my daughter, who was running up the stairs, saying, Mommy, there was somebody in the house, and so forth. And she didn't even report the sexual assault at that time to my wife. She was just concerned that there was somebody who came into our house and took something that wasn't his. Well, my wife immediately called 911, and over the course of the next few hours, you know, she reported what had happened, and I got a phone call. It was around 4 a.m. I actually was in Pennsylvania at the time. My father was in intensive care, and telling me what had happened. So I logged onto my AT&T account and discovered that this gentleman had made a phone call. And so I called the Hillsborough police right away and told them the phone number and started to find my way back to Oregon. By the time I'd reached Chicago, my father had passed away. By the time I'd landed on the ground here in Oregon, an entire story unfolded that seemed just too surreal to be true. The phone number that I gave them was the phone number of the rape victim from the night before. And the police, the Hillsborough police were awesome. They knew what they were doing. They knew right away, oh my gosh, we think we know this guy. And so it turned out the night before, the man had raped a woman who lived right across the street from his facility. He climbed in through her window and raped her. Thanks to the swift work of the Hillsborough police detectives, and even with some obstruction from the folks at Luckdorf, they were able to use my phone and capture him and bring him into custody. And then over the coming days and weeks and months, through community meetings and some basic web searches, the folly of the county, the state, and Luckdorf that led to my daughter's assault became clearer. First, Mr. Heath came to my community after being arrested for breaking into someone's home in Tigard. Now that in itself doesn't seem like much, but the people were home and the lights were on. Mr. Heath went into their home, stole their identity, stole their car, and was subsequently, they caught him and arrested him, brought him back to Hillsborough, where he was able to go into mental health court. And after the pieces came together later, it turned out he'd been diagnosed with schizophrenia while in prison in Arizona. Now, the mental health court, it's designed for those with, you know, a serious mental illness. And according to their website, the individuals can be referred to any community mental health provider dependent on eligibility and clinical match. The documents show that Mr. Heath was released into the custody of Luckdorf. So presumably this is a clinical match for the man. He was when they had him there, he'd only been there like 5 weeks. And it was clear he had an alcohol substance abuse problem as well as a mental illness. And from the county's side, this was came out at our meetings when we challenged to try to figure out what had happened. How could this possibly happen? Was it just a quirk, something weird? Well, we had the parole officer tell us there were no red flags with Mr. Heath. I sat there in the audience. I did not identify myself as the father of the victim. But just in the audience that day on my cell phone, I discovered that Mr. Heath had a prison record across three states, that he was disciplined while incarcerated for assault and possession of a weapon, that he had solicited sex openly on social networking sites. He had rap music available for download on his sites that he made, that he authored, detailing violence and sexual aggression against women. And his favorite authors were the people behind gangster rap, essentially, Donald Goins and Iceberg Slim. I learned all this in the course of a community meeting on my cell phone. If there was some sort of licensing, maybe there would have been a little bit more care given to understanding, gee, was this guy really a good candidate for this kind of place? Because clearly there was violence. And this, to hear this man tell me that there were no red flags as a father of the victim, I was seething, you know. And so where are we now? We're 18 months after the events of July 2010, and my family's still shaken. My wife, there's no way she could have appeared today. She felt it was important that we came down, but she couldn't come today. She didn't feel that she could stand up to talking about it again. Everyone in our family required at least a year of therapy, and my children continue to be in therapy. One of my sons, who's the twin brother of the girl who was assaulted, still fears break-ins, still fears that this particular man's going to come to my house and hurt us. You know, the alarm system I've installed, all this stuff, it's not enough. It's not enough. He still feels afraid. My family lives in fear. We have a beautiful park that I can see from my house that I cannot let my 12-year-old kids play at by themselves unsupervised because of the fact that Mr. Heath was playing basketball there less than 12 hours before he assaulted my daughter. Would you let your children play in that kind of environment? I mean, imagine thinking about a 12-year-old kid. They want to go out. They want to ride their bicycles. I can't allow that in my own community because the system let somebody get through an unlicensed facility So there was no due diligence to look into his background to figure out if he was a good candidate. And now we end up with more people with mental health problems, my family, that, you know, we're the victims. And yet I've had to keep defending my position when all I do is pay taxes, enrich the community by volunteering, and what I've gotten out of it was this, among other things. But for today, this was it was a heck of a loss, you know, and my family will be shaken by this, and it's going to stick around for a long time. And that's all I've got. Thank you.
One more.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, committee members. My name is Linda Mokler. I'm a resident of downtown Hillsborough. I am also here with the Hillsborough Neighborhoods Coalition. We're here in support of House Bill 4159. This bill clarifies existing state statutes and does not impose any new criteria on service providers in any way. We believe, as Judy pointed out, that licensing benefits the clients, the employees, and the communities in which they're located. And by doing licensing mandates, staffing levels, staff training, it imposes risk factors on the licensee as to the level of risk offenders they can bring in. Currently, in the instance of Luckdorf, they can take any and all comers at their own discretion. So the community really has no belief that the facility is being run appropriately. Judy has pointed out that there are also other facilities that are operating in the same manner. We believe the clarifications in the bill are necessary in order to safeguard the well-being of clients, community members, and employees. We're just seeking to close some gaps. Representative Ayers already has spoken about those. In the digital copy of the complaint that the Hillsborough Neighborhoods Coalition has filed electronically, you guys have received electronically and was filed with the OHA, it clearly demonstrates that the state regulatory agencies have turned a blind eye to the actions that are going, the licensing requirements of the facilities. In our instance, the Addictions and Mental Health Division took months to conduct a superficial investigation, which resulted in a flawed outcome, allowing Luckdorf to continue to operate in the very same manner it was in July 2010 when these assaults occurred. Our amendment makes clear that all concerns regarding unlicensed facilities are to be addressed and thoroughly investigated and the law enforced. One of the ways that we're doing that is by saying when a complaint comes or a concern is raised regarding an unlicensed facility, the Department of Health and Human Services, which regulates residential care facilities, and the Oregon Health Administration, which regulates treatment facilities, will come together and decide whose purview this particular facility falls under. This will expedite the process, make it more efficient, and allow us to come to a conclusion much quicker. It's oftentimes unclear where to go when there is no existing license in place. One of the other things that we saw in the AMH memo was that Luckdorf and AMH put forth that since treatment was only provided on an as-needed basis, it was not planned, and therefore did not fall within the regulatory definition of treatment, and therefore require licensing. It's clear to us that the intent of the legislature was that facilities providing treatment would be licensed to ensure that the clients receive the quality care that they need. Let's keep in mind that licensing is in place to protect the residents, not the community. It does give the community peace of mind that the facility is being appropriately run. But licensing is about the welfare of the clients and their success. And we really do all want them to be successful, because we have some pretty horrific examples of what can happen when they're not. We've also asked that there be a change in the exclusion of any place that provides less than 24-hour treatment. This was another loophole that Luke Dorf and AMH tried to exploit by having simply as needed on call, supposedly on call services 24 hours. They argued that they did not provide treatment, planned treatment, on a 24-hour basis. It's clear to us that the legislature meant that 24-hour treatment meant access to 24-hour treatment, and we'd just like to have that more clearly stated. So that's why we've come to those conclusions. Now, it is always a concern when talking about residential treatment facilities that we don't run afoul of the federal fair housing laws and ADA laws. House Bill 4159 does not put any additional restrictions on the siting of facilities. It simply clarifies the term local community. And Representative Ayer presented a couple of different options that are available to us in that. I do want to call to your attention a case that was filed in Multnomah County Court against Luke Dorf, Inc.
Thank you. Yeah, we do have another bill after this with lots of witnesses, and so I don't want to rush you, but I do want to ask you to please.
Okay.
And you have, appreciate written testimony.
Okay, you have in your possession a suit that was filed for unfair dismissal by Luke Dorf employee Stoop Nielsen. She raised safety concerns about dirty needles being strewn throughout the facility. She was fired. The court found that she claimed whistleblower status. Luke Dorf argued that she did not have that whistleblower status, since the Bridgeview community in which she worked did not, in their estimation, meet the statutory definition of a treatment facility. So currently, people working in these facilities do not have whistleblower protections, as was required by state law. Also, we're seeking to curtail the incidence of unlicensed facilities. We've spoken about three of those today and the dangerous outcomes that they have produced. Currently, Washington County is seeking to open another such facility in Alloa. It's due to be be accepting residents in May, and it is along the same models, providing clinical treatment and housing and support services to mentally ill, drug-addicted people within the community.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. We greatly appreciate you coming here today. And I want to leave a question.
Do you have any questions?
Yes, Representative Shoffley.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony. Having grown up in a rather dysfunctional environment and experiencing every kind of mental, emotional, and physical abuse you can imagine, I can relate to your daughter's experience. As a father of a daughter, 18-year-old daughter, I can relate to how you feel. Every window and door in my house has an alarm. We can leave the windows open because the screens have an alarm, and I'm very well prepared and equipped to deal with any problem. My little dog lights up. Believe me, I'll spare you the graphic description of what I would do and how you feel in your case. So I appreciate your testimony. I also appreciate your testimony in sympathizing with these perpetrators. My mother was schizophrenic, my brother's bipolar, and we are failing these folks. I don't think anyone's born and grows up and wants to become a freak. That being said, now I'm going to put my legislator hat on. We're going to place these facilities somewhere, and you all know that. I do agree and sympathize with the lack of regulation here. That's clear. The 10-mile radius study, that
I think is kind of an obstacle. I'm just going to be quite, and Representative, just let me finish. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Clearly, things fell through the cracks here, and perfectly innocent people suffered horribly. But that one part of the bill, I think, it costs a lot of money. And when they say anything about the money, it's about the money. And I hate to even talk about the money in front of you, but as I'm not heartless, that's why I prefaced my comments. I just wanted to share that concern with you, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hicks and Representative Schaffler. I appreciate that concern. We do have a clustering of homes, but we have two goals here. One is to clarify what type of facility should, in fact, be licensed, and the second was to approach that issue in community needs. Amendment 1 actually reduces it down to 5 miles, which is counter to your concern. But then Amendment 2, which has been filed, actually restores back the original language, which says about measuring at the local community level. So Dash 2 Amendment puts back the original language. And to move this bill, which we believe is the higher need that we have and higher desire, we are happy to restore that language in the Dash 2 Amendments. Sorry, I thought it was handed out. I'm sorry.
Representative Clement.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Vice Chair. Whatever. Representative Hicks. Thank you for coming today, and thank you especially, sir, for coming to testify. I can't imagine what that would be like to be in your position and then come again and talk about it publicly. My heart goes out to you. All of us here are parents or soon to be parents, and our hearts break hearing your story. So thank you for coming to testify.
Further questions?
Mr. Co-Chair, may I just make a quick closing remark? What we have here, what's come to my attention is we have a type of facility that truly acts and advertises itself and does employment hiring as and acts like a licensed facility. It holds itself out meeting all of those types of goals that would be achieved by a licensed facility. To use the term, if it acts like a duck, quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, it probably is a duck. In this particular case, we added medical management as one of the criteria, and that is because in this facility, the medication of these residents, these tenants, are locked up and then distributed according to a physician's plan of medication. And then again, the access to on-site care, they have folks that they hire within the organization for 24-hour service if needed at any of those facilities. Because those folks are not on-site 24 hours but have access, but the residents have access to them 24 hours, to employees, to service providers on the payroll of this organization, that is also why we added access to on-site care. So this bill does three simple things if we go back to local community. It adds medication management as a criteria for licensing, and the rest is consistent or current language. And then rather than on-site care, it adds access to on-site care. And then, of course, we have the overlapping authority. It says for these two agencies to decide who has the authority when investigating someone operating without a license. So that is all this bill is asking outside of the 10-mile radius, which we've addressed. And so if a facility acts like it's licensed and provides those services that the community and the residents assume is licensed, we would like that accountability, and that's all this bill does. Thank you for your generous time in hearing this, and thank you to my citizens for having the courage to come forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all so much. Bob Jundeff, Kevin McChesney. And again, we're against the clock. We always value the testimony from these two gentlemen, and we'll ask to keep it short.
Co-Chair Hicks, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights of Oregon. Our organization, of course, advocates for the rights of people with disabilities, including mental illness, and we're extremely troubled by the testimony we've heard today, and our heart goes out to the victims. Given that the problems that have been presented, we do not believe that House Bill 4159 will address those problems. And in fact, in our opinion, would violate the federal fair housing law and the ADA if it were enacted, both in its present form and as amended, as it would be amended in the dash one and dash twos. Having said that, I think, unless there's questions, I will conclude.
And let's hear from Mr. McChesney, and then we'll address questions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I represent the Oregon Residential Providers Association, which represents nearly all of the licensed residential providers in the state of Oregon. I think we have chosen to oppose House Bill 4159 because it has some unintended consequences that I think are extremely important to consider. One of the changes is it adds the words substantially to less than a 24-hour basis in determining whether a facility is excluded from the licensing requirement or not. And this could be broadly interpreted since there's no definition of substantially. And actually, the licensing requirements state very clearly that if you have a license, you're required to have 24-hour awake staff on site. So the addition of the word substantially seems to just cloud the matter rather than clarify for purposes of licensing. The addition of medication management is also a significant issue for providers of service. As a licensed provider, if you were providing just medication management services, that would not be sufficient in order to maintain a license. There are many, many other services that need to be provided to people with a severe and persistent mental illness. And medication management is just one small component of that. One of the unintended consequences of adding that language is that there are assertive community treatment teams that provide services to individuals with disabilities who live in low-income housing. And the way this is written, if you've got several of those individuals who live in an apartment building, for instance, and they are being visited by a nurse who is a member of the assertive community treatment team who's monitoring their medications and documenting that they're taking them, that could be constituted as then requiring a license for that entire apartment building.
Okay, thank you very much. And we always welcome written testimony and value what you've said here today. And I want to make sure there's opportunity for questions, Representative Shoffler.
Very briefly, thanks guys for coming. And this is very challenging, it's very emotional, clearly. But clearly there's a problem here. I mean, we just heard the problem, and it's real, and it's there. It's our job to solve problems. And if you oppose this, fine, I respect your opposition. I think you made some obviously managerial points. But I want you two guys to go find those people and find a solution. That's what I'm asking you to do. Because we need to do something. We cannot continue on like this. So I'm not going to accept that just you sit coming up here and opposing this. I want both of you gentlemen to go find those people and figure something out and then bring it back and then we'll do it. That's what I'm asking you to do. Because I really want to do something about this. So there you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Hughes. Further questions? Okay, there being none, I'm going to, and that being the last witness, any other witnesses on this bill? None. Okay, I'm going to carry over 4159 till Monday and close the public hearing. I now open a public hearing on House Bill 4021.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4021 comes to you from Representative Barker, requires the Superintendent of State Police to commission employees of the Humane Society as human special agents if the employee is certified by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the agent furnishes the State Police with a copy of insurance policy to satisfy any tort claims against the agent. So, Chair, members of the committee, that is currently under a very old statute, the governor has a right to appoint special agents. He does.
in behalf of the Humane Society so they can enforce Oregon's laws against cruelty to animals. This would more formalize that and send it more under the superintendent of the state police, who would issue certifications and also have the right to withdraw them.
Tom Buchholz, Sharon Harmon, and Mr. Blitz.
Go ahead and end your, just be sure you identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are an independent organization unaffiliated with any other group, including the Humane Society of the United States. I appreciate Mr. Taylor's description of the bill. We're really talking about the Oregon Humane Society, even though it references Humane Society. We're the only organization in Oregon eligible for this provision. We've worked over the years to try to professionalize, but put standards in place that bring our law enforcement officers in line with all other law enforcement officers in the state. We've added statutes along the years, and we've tried working with industry over time to find common ground. And I think this year, we've done that. We know that the bill as it stands now, there are still some issues that I think are workable, and we will continue to work through those. Truly, this bill doesn't do anything more than move us from the governor's office to the superintendent of state police. Doesn't add authority, doesn't broaden authority, doesn't give us more power, doesn't give us, doesn't make us state-funded agencies. It just shifts us from the political office of the governor to the superintendent of state police. I think that's been in line with the wishes of this body and of our community as well. The gentleman to my right here is Aiken Blitz. He's a member of our board of trustees, and I would like him to take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Chairman Barker, thank you very much. Members of the committee, my name is Aiken Blitz. I'd like to begin, if I may, by thanking each of you for your service. I worked with Senate Judiciary a very long time ago, and I know that this is one of the, got to be one of the hardest working committees in the building, and I appreciate your hard work on the challenging issues that tend to gravitate to the two Judiciary committees. So thank you each of you very much. I have served in Oregon as a police officer, as a deputy sheriff, a prosecutor. I served in the Marine Corps for a time, an assistant attorney general, and my career has been defined for me, consistent with my passions for animals and policing. My legal career has been defined by representing local governments and police departments, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and others. I've defended the police. I know an awful lot about law enforcement risk management. As a new trustee 5 or 6 years ago, it was very important to me in the advice that I gave Sharon, we need to do as much as we can to professionalize the investigations unit and ensure that these officers meet all of the same qualifications that every other law enforcement officer in the state meets. And this bill represents the culmination of steps we have taken in concert with the chiefs and the sheriffs and DPSST. And it shifts accountability, as Sharon mentioned, it shifts our accountability to the superintendent of state police, a chief law enforcement executive with the expertise that is needed to oversee a police function. And we think that's appropriate for us It's good for us, and it's certainly good for the law enforcement agencies with to which whom we which we assist and serve. I want to just touch on a couple of points. We bear the full cost of sending our folks to the Oregon Police Academy. The humane agent is no different in training and qualification than any other Oregon police officer. They're subject to DPSST rules because we asked that DPSST assume jurisdiction over us. So background investigations, qualifications of our officers, fitness, ethics, standards of conduct, training, in-service training, in-service retraining, even the FTO process is identical to that of any police officer in the state. We have arranged for our ongoing in-service training to be conducted in conjunction with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. That's an important feature of the investigations department because it doesn't really serve our folks very well to be involved in an insular, self-supervised three police officer program. As I indicated, this is the next logical step, and I think the final step that we seek. There is no change in what we do from what we're doing now. There will be some changes that we seek in the bill. I understand, Chairman Barker, this bill will be for the committee in work session next week. We will seek an amendment today that clarifies language of the bill consistent with discussions I have had with the Superintendent of State Police to ensure that the commissioning authority is what was intended. And I think the bill is a little bit off target in its current version, but our officers will be subject to his authority and they will serve at his pleasure in the final drafting. Of the final version of the bill. And I'd be happy to take any questions that any of you may have.
Thank you. I guess the question would be to one of you. So why do you want this change? What's going to be the advantage to you? That's one question. The second question was, there's something stated in here about PERS, I think, in your written testimony. So will your PERS status change? I'm just wondering why you want this change.
Representative Hoy, Chairman Barker, if I may, if there is any reference to PERS in this bill, it is a provision of the bill that was considered appropriate by legislative counsel to ensure that our folks do not participate in PERS. We are a private nonprofit 501c organization, 100% of the services that we provide are funded with privately raised donated dollars. We, for example, devoted over $60,000 of resource to helping Sheriff Dickerson recently in Columbia County in terms of the expertise that we brought to bear. So our folks participate in a corporate retirement plan to the same extent as all the other employees, the 100-plus employees of the Oregon Humane Society. So there is no retirement impact. As for your second question with respect to why do we want this bill, we are blessed with a person who is recognized throughout America and who has been honored nationally as the most outstanding executive director of an Oregon Humane of a humane society, a shelter organization such as we are. And for all of Sharon's strengths, and in spite of the fact that she worked as a peace officer and cruelty humane officer under a very comprehensive statute in California very early in her career, she is not a professional chief law enforcement officer. And because of what they do and because of my sense as a trustee that taking this law enforcement department and creating that it has shared accountability to Sharon, our executive director, for everything that we do and the priorities of service that are identified and the day-to-day routines and the extent to which the veterinary services are made available to assist in necropsies and medical forensics in relation to these criminal cases. She's not a police chief. She's not a sheriff. And what we have assisted law enforcement all over the state. We think that by bringing the law enforcement function, the extending of commissions, law enforcement commissions to the superintendent, that is a better thing for the people of Oregon, for us and for the state as a governmental body than having it be a function of the governor's office and legal counsel to the governor, which is where this has always been. And I think Governor Kitzhaber, to the best of my knowledge, agrees with that. He may not be articulating active support for the bill, but he's certainly not opposed to it. And there have been conversations with him about it. So he is very supportive of the Oregon Humane Society. I'm certainly not here speaking for him. To the best of my knowledge, neither is Sharon, but we have worked with the superintendent. We have worked with the governor in getting here today.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, and thank you for pointing that out, Representative. Being a union thug, I'm not too fond of scab labor, and I don't like my tax dollars going to cheap labor to provide a service, and I'm not suggesting you good people are either. By the way, how's your dog doing?
It's fine.
Good, good. I had the pleasure of taking my daughter and my niece and my little girl's friend years ago when they were little girls out to the Humane Society. Ms. Harmon was gracious and generous enough to tour us through it. But so what kind of pack, what kind of compensation, what kind of retirement, what do we have, what are these officers getting? Are they being taken care of and compensated at a level that I would accept as a taxpayer? Can you share that with me?
Sharon can probably, Representative Schaffler, Chairman Barker, members of the committee, Sharon can probably give you a fixed dollar number. We have taken to employing retired police officers for their skill sets and qualifications, officers who have passion for animals and passion for what we do. We feel we pay them well. In addition to the wonderful benefits that they are, that some of them are currently receiving through PERS.
Mr. Chair, that's the pool you draw from exclusively, correct? Retired police officers, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, that is certainly the best pool to draw from, and that has been the target of our hiring practices. Truly, these are the cream of the crop, these officers, and you're going to meet one shortly. Officer Alan Zog will be up here, and you can grill him as well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? Please.
Thank you, Chairman Barker, for the opportunity to speak today. Why am I here today?
You need to
Oh, my name is Tom Buchholz.
Thank you.
Why am I here today? In 1991, I had a Multnomah County Animal Control officer, a sheriff, and two Portland police officers in my yard. My animal was removed from my yard because of my alleged, finally I was convicted, neglect. The animal, The animal was taken to Multnomah Animal Control, where it was given 144 hours to live if I didn't show up to get my ticket. I didn't particularly like the fact that the animal control officer, the only non-certified person in my yard, wrote me the citation. He also took my animal without a search warrant, and my dog was, because of my neglect, was going to be killed in 144 hours. I have contended that animal control officers, both city and county, have worked above the law for many years, decades actually, and now we have it happening at the state level. In May of last year, I asked my Senator Alan Olson some questions about the Humane Society. The Legislative Council stated, a Humane Society employee who is employed as a special agent may be viewed as a joint or dual employee under the hire by two different employers. There is no inherent inconsistency between a person being paid employee of the Humane Society and rendering a gratuitous service to the state of Oregon as a special agent. Well, in the Supreme Court, Thornton versus Williams, 1958, our legislature has gone as far to meet the governor's constitutional obligation, which is to see that the laws are faithfully enforced. It has vested in him the power to employ special agents. It appears that the Legislative Council overlooked the Attorney General's opinion dated October 29, 1937. The Honorable Governor Charles H. Martin submitted a form for commissioning the appointment of special agents. It reads as follows: reposing confidence in the State of Oregon, I hereby commission him as a special agent for the State of Oregon to serve at the pleasure of this office, but no later than 1930, without state compensation, in accordance with the provisions under 67-105 Oregon Code 1930. Well, that's a form of ORS 131-805. To this, Attorney General I.H. Van Winkle states, it appears that you indicate that your intention in issuing it is to create a general, which the laws were called then, they were called general laws, or a roving commission, which would be statewide, like the state police. And your attention is called to the fact that the state of Oregon does not authorize the granting of such commissions, but limits the exercise powers, therefore granted to you, to specific cases, and provides that reasonable salaries shall be paid for services rendered. The above commission form may have been suggested for the appointment of a humane welfare investigator in 1937. I don't know. But I provided documents here, and on the back page here, there's one called Oregon 49-18-15. It has to do with labor, has to do with hazardous occupations. Under Section 2, it's for special and temporary officers who are appointed and paid by the state or any political division thereof for such special or temporary services as peace officers. It states in Section 4, the state, counties, municipal corporations shall be deemed employers under the terms of this act and shall be paid to the accident fund the payments required of employees by this act.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Buckles, I'm having a hard time following you. I'm not sure what your position is here.
My position is that these are made for state employees. This bill, 131-805, which is the governor now currently uses to employ. It says employ. See, my complaint to the my senator was is that it states that judges can't insert words in the laws and that they can't omit words. Well, it says in the law, 131-805, that the governor may employ special agents.
So are you in support or in opposition to this?
I'm not in opposition. I just want the law followed, ma'am.
I see. Okay, thank you. That helps me.
Yeah, I have no problem here, but I think that the people are naive. You guys operate at the state level, but when you get down to it, these laws are being enforced at the county and city level. It took me 2 years to change 22 pages of laws in Clackamas County, thanks to the help of Commissioner Larry Soa. I had Wayne Scott, Representative Wayne Scott, helping me with the governor, but the governor just chose to ignore all of my, you know, concerns. And I think that he's been, especially not so much the prior governor, Ted Kulongowski, that he, these people have been getting search warrants in 2007. In 2009, you guys gave him the authority. But the problem is, in his contract with him, he gave him the authority in 2003 to get search warrants, and he doesn't have that authority. He also gave him the authority to execute him. Well, these people still don't have the right to execute him because they can only be executed by a state police. And they don't have the authority to write the criminal citations that they've been writing because you guys didn't take 131.005 and put their name in it. Their name is, they're not authorized under the word peace officer, which is defined. In 1973, you guys rewrote all the criminal code. And it stopped peace officers after that. The Liquor Commission had a clear statutory authority to get search warrants. Well, they were told in 1973 by Attorney General that they no longer had that authority because their name didn't appear on the word police officer. The only police officers they wanted to get search warrants were sheriffs, state police, and a municipal policeman. They put the emphasis on municipal policemen. They didn't want, like, railroad policemen or other policemen to get search warrants. And
I'd like to know, if I may, about your animal. Were you able to save your animal?
I was. I went over to get my animal, but they didn't like my attitude. So I had to go back in and throw myself on the ground and start crying to get my animal. Too bad that Suzanne Laverne, the lady who was not convicted after me, they had killed her animal in 144 hours. And that law is still on the books in Multnomah County.
And I'll ask our attorneys to take a look at what you're saying here, to take a look into that.
I would appreciate that. That's all I ask.
Okay, I understand that. Thank you for your testimony.
And I have, I mean, the legislative council, he quotes the attorney general's opinions in here that he wants to quote, but he overlooked the one that counts.
If you can leave that with us, we'll have our attorney
stand. Yeah, you should have it in my...
in the packet. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Kevin Campbell, Glenn Kolb, and Alan Zengi, is it?
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We're here to support House Bill 4021 with the addition of the Dash 1 amendments. We think those amendments are important. From our association's perspective, I'd just like to say a few things to keep this brief because we're running out of time. Two things. First of all, the Humane Society has handled their commission well over the years. They've had it for 100 years, and I don't think you've heard many complaints, despite the fact that they're a nonprofit trying to oversee a policing effort. The second thing I want to applaud them for is they came to us because they're interested in being under an official law enforcement entity. That is something we support wholeheartedly. We believe that fully trained police officers should be accountable to a policing agency. Because they're a resource to all our county and city police departments throughout the state on issues that we don't have expertise in for the most part, we believe the state police is the logical place for them to be. We've worked closely with the Humane Society on those Dash 1 amendments to ensure that the superintendent has the ability to appoint these agents, but to ensure that the agents can be hired in a way that's proper, the same way they would hire an Oregon State Police officer. There is a concern that we believe we can address before the committee on Monday to clarify that the superintendent also has the ability to remove that commission once they appoint. If there's any concern that the superintendent has, just as the superintendent would do for any other employee that they have under their control. Now, all of these officers are fully trained through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. They have the same certification. They have the same ongoing maintenance training requirements. They are full police officers, but they do have a limited scope of authority. So they have all the abilities that any other police officer has in the state, but they have some limits on what they can do. That's great, and that's very appropriate. We feel strongly that this makes perfect sense, and I appreciate the time today. I do think there is one other question that's been floating around that I'd be glad to respond to regarding whether they should be armed or not, but I think I'll let the two folks to my left and right speak, and then if anybody has a question, I'd be glad to answer that, and I appreciate the committee's time.
Thank you.
Good morning, chairs and committee members. My name is Alan Zog, and I'm one of the special agents commissioned by the Oregon Humane Society and through the governor's office. I have been in this position now for just under a year. It will be a year at the end of March. Prior to my employment by the Oregon Humane Society, I was a police officer with the city of Hillsborough. I was there for 27 years and retired with the rank of commander. A couple of things that I've learned in my short tenure with the Oregon Humane Society is that in my 28 plus years of law enforcement experience, I came across many situations involving animal abuse and negligent care to the animals and didn't really recognize what I was saying because I didn't have the proper training to go with that. Also, another thing that I learned, especially as a police officer with the city of Hillsborough, the importance of having an Oregon Humane Society as an asset or a resource to go through. I don't know if anybody recalls a rabbit hoarder case that we had involving a Marion Sackowitz. We could not have survived as a police agency without the assistance of the Oregon Humane Society in that situation. Let's just say that we ended up with more rabbits than we started with in that situation. The third thing that I've learned in my short stint with the Humane Society is that I am dealing with the same individuals that I did as a deputy sheriff with Union County, as a police officer at the city of Pendleton, and as a police officer with the city of Hillsborough. The only thing that I think that has changed is that there is a larger percentage of these individuals do have some mental health issues. One of the things that now a part of the resource, let's just say, that the Oregon Humane Society can provide. I have had the opportunity to investigate many cases throughout the state of Oregon and assist other agencies with these investigations. I have also had the opportunity to put on some briefing training and in-service training to law enforcement agencies in the Portland metro area to help them recognize what animal neglect and animal abuse is so that they don't run into the same situation that I did and not recognize what they were looking at. By moving us from the governor's office to the state police department helps put us in line with what we're doing out there. So I would strongly urge you to accept this bill and help us serve the citizens of this great state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee members, my name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I am not a veterinarian, but I am here on behalf of our organization, fully in support of House Bill 4021. Yeah, we see it from a little slightly different perspective in the sense that our members across Oregon are on the treating end of neglected and abused animals. You can have anything from simple neglect, might be a malnourished dog or cat, a dog infested with fleas. A lot of that is remediated by education, discussion with a client. But then you get to more serious neglect and animal abuse, and that could be embedded collars in the neck of an animal, contusions, burns, fractures, more serious crimes with horses. It could be some greatly malnourished, undernourished horses, too. And so when we look at that, in cooperation with other law enforcement agencies, humane special agents with the Oregon Humane Society are essential to our state to address these issues. We agree the appropriate placement is a commission through the Oregon State Police. These are certified, educated, trained individuals, and our experience is that they have a broader and greater knowledge and experience in investigating cruelty and neglect cases than anybody else in the state of Oregon. And therefore, we support House Bill 4021 and encourage your support as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell and Glenn and Mrs. Harmon, remember last session we had the abuse in kennels, and so I hope constituents are still encouraging us to do something about that, so I'll be working with you to see. I think this is a good move, and once this move is see how we want to address that in our current laws as far as having to look at kennels and be sure that they're not abusing animal abuse. Thank you for coming to testify today.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, it kind of gets to your follow-up with DPSST that you mentioned that, and I kind of want to put this to rest. There's been some concern about the firearm carrying issue for these positions.
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, there's two reasons why our association feels strongly that a fully trained police officer should have the full range of equipment regarding use of force in the carrying out of their duties. I'll give you two examples. One I've used before this committee before. It's a problem we have now with OHSU police where they're currently not allowed to be armed. That's one of the busiest emergency rooms in the state, and unfortunately, it's just not accidents and injuries that end up there, but it could be gunshot wounds. It can be the result of gang activity. People are transported there, and unfortunately, the violence sometimes follows there. Unfortunately, those police are not armed, and so the Portland police are called when they get into trouble, and it's happened on a number of occasions. When that happens, by the time the Portland police are there, the situation has escalated now to a point where police officers and other innocent victims are now at risk because there wasn't the proper equipment on hand at the time. The second reason our association feels very strongly about this is that I would guess, Representative Olson, when you went out as a police officer to do your work, your spouse, your wife, cared about you being fully protected when you went out on duty. The fact is that when the human agents go out and they work with our officers out on a case, a lot of these times, these are just not friendly animal neglect cases. A lot of this criminal activity around animals is directly related to other more violent crime, including drug abuse, drug dealing, and other things. And these are officers, they're fully trained. Now you're telling them they can't carry their weapon with them. They're by definition now, for the other police officers at the scene, they're a liability and they're in danger. And for those two reasons, we feel strongly that the superintendent in the Dash 1 amendments should have the authority to arm these folks. It doesn't say the superintendent must, but in the Dash 1 amendments, it gives the superintendent the ability to make that determination. I feel strongly that makes good sense for people like Alan, who are going to be out on the, you know, putting their life on the line like other officers. I think it's only right and fitting that they're able to carry a firearm with them.
Just Mr. Chair, briefly, yes. So we got state police doing gray machines, and we're going to have some retired state police, I hope, regulating tobacco and with full arrest authority. Mr. Chair, I think, and Ms. Harmon said we're hiring retired police officers to do, the law enforcement officers to do this. We should, I feel much more comfortable with them having a gun, knowing that, obviously. But I think we should give them full arrest authority as well. It's just like when Representative Krieger was out there in the bush doing fish and wildlife, he could arrest any freak for doing anything wrong, not just somebody poaching. Mm-hmm. And I think that, be quite frankly, I think that's what we should do here, and allow them to respond if a deputy or a state police officer or police officers in distress for an unrelated to animal abuse situation. And we get two for one, and we save money and catch freaks and throw them in jail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair, members of security, Mr. Campbell, you mentioned that OSHU does not allow its security officers to carry firearms. Is that a condition of employment, or is that a statutory prohibition?
Chair Barker and Council Taylor, actually, this bill was passed by the legislature with a strict prohibition against these officers having weapons. They're not security guards. They're fully trained police officers, and they have a full police department. But at the time the bill was passed, and we would like to revisit that, this is not the time to do that, there was a strict prohibition in that bill that prevents them from carrying a firearm.
And if I remember correctly, OSHU is a state entity. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Where we're talking about Humane Societies being is a nonprofit private entity. So we would be prohibiting, as a condition of employment, them carrying their firearm?
Chair Barker and Council Taylor, I think that that it would be true, but I'd need to check on that to make sure. We feel like the language of the bill is important. If that determination it lies with the superintendent, we think he should have that authority to make that decision.
Or be a condition of issuing the license, I take it.
Council Taylor, I am not sure that I understand or am capable of answering the question to your satisfaction, but I would guess that Aiken Blitz, who testified earlier, would have an answer for you. And I would prefer not to take a shot in the dark.
Chair, members of the committee, the reason I'm just raising that is I spent a lot of time since September on concealed handgun permits, and I'm just trying to figure out how the two would mesh. Thank you.
Why did you waste all that time? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We'll roll this over for work session on Monday as well. Get things caught up in the amendments.
Thank you.
Any further business before the... I'm sorry. Does somebody else want to testify on that bill? Please come up. I'm sorry. I'll reopen. I didn't have you on the schedule.
No problem. I had sent a note in. But thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the ability to testify. For the record, Katie Fast at the Oregon Farm Bureau. We have been engaged in this issue for several sessions and are supportive of moving the Humane Agent Program into OSP. However, we do have concerns with the Dash 1 amendments and the ability to carry firearms. That is laid out in lines 15 to 18. Currently, the officers do not carry firearms. You've heard that discussion. For my members, they are very uncomfortable with giving that authority to a nonprofit employee and see quite a different distinction between a state employee or a county deputized county sheriff and a nonprofit employee. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. I am sympathetic. And if it was just some, you know, warm and fuzzy do-gooder, feel-gooder out there doing this, I can appreciate who really had an agenda. But since I found out they're retired police officers, I think they should just be sworn police officers, period, and somehow figure that out. So I don't know what we're going to do, but I told you what I thought. Then after the testimony, I feel a lot better about them carrying firearms now. I don't think they're out there to get bust, you know, farmers because they're butchering cattle. Because I like to eat that myself. So I share your concern, but I feel much more comfortable after just.
And if I could respond, Chair Barker, Representative Schaffler. There's no guarantee that those officers will always be retired state patrol. There are some requirements in legislation that they will have the proper training, but there's still that. I mean, that's a current practice. We don't know what the practice will be in 10 years.
Right. And they are fully trained through the police training like every other commissioned officer. And I feel a little safer with the superintendent of the state police being in charge, because if you have somebody who isn't acting right without any, you don't have any big rigor moral, he can just go bang, you're no longer. We're doing, they can pull the commission immediately. But thank you very much for your testimony. That's important to hear from you.
Before you gavel out, could we find out if there have been any problems where a Humane Society officer had gone out and they would have been served better if they'd had a firearm?
I think we had testimony last session where there were some where they were endangered by some people a time or two.
But nobody was hurt, is that what you're saying? I'm just wondering how important it is that somebody be able to carry a firearm.
I can speak to that.
Well, then they could. Anybody can. You can carry a firearm if it's exposed without a permit. So, okay, we'll close the hearing today. Any further business before the committee? Meeting adjourned.